Well, a warm weekend ahead and plenty on the radio from a day in the life of a Cistercian nun and the winner of the big DIY challenge to finding a new home for a swarm of bees. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
You know, the idea of offering up suffering for Jesus, this is not something nobody has ever heard of. This is a teaching. We understand this. But it's just taken to kind of a very banana pants level, you know.
If I wanted to get a powerboat, I'd have to do a powerboat license. But to get a jet ski, I just have to have a few quid in my pocket.
Then we do what we call the cannon, which is 9 centimetres.
Okay.
We have a bishop at 12 centimetres, and we have a cardinal at 15 centimetres.
That's
but we've
brilliant.
Not yet got around to making a pope.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And we'll start here on the live line. And Philomena in Galway called Joe about a very large colony of bees in her roof.
Well, the problem is, Joe, I've sent on photographs. They arrived in spring 2018 and we didn't really notice them, I suppose, until the July or August.
Okay.
And since then, I have had two people look at them that are beekeepers, and one of them said that a part of the roof would have to be removed and it would cost me like 2,500 to 3,000.
Wow.
To get them. But the house, you know, there's the board, the aero board was in it, and then a number of years, it was built in 2016, and a number of years later, we got the beadin pumped into the cavity block.
Mm-hmm.
So what the beekeeper, one of them said to me, that they've got into the fascia.
Okay.
And now I got my son to get me a hand smoker because we have the third level in the house, which is like an office, as attic.
Okay.
And there's a little hole.
Well, can I ask you, Philomena, what harm are they doing?
Yeah, you see, this is what I want to know. Like, can they harm? I'd be just afraid that they would, you know, come down through the ceiling, the honey, or can it harm?
And, well, don't disturb them now. You know that. Try not.
Oh, I know that. Yes, yeah. But I was just checking with the hand smoker. There's a little opening where a light fitting is go, and I put some pine leaves and that into it, and I put it up and I press the bellow thing, smoke, to put the smoke up there, and it did disturb them. They got a bit agitated, so they actually have come in, you know, to the attic area, to the ceiling above the attic. And I'm just, you know, would like to get them moved. But if they're not going to do any harm to the house or us, because they are very placid, they would, you know, they wouldn't, they're not, let's say, you know, they wouldn't be crossed.
Well, unless they think the queen bee is in danger and the worker bees will protect her.
Yeah,
and I know wasps swarm and bees swarm.
Yes.
And it can be extraordinarily dangerous.
Yes, yes. But I just
so you're looking for, is there any beekeepers out there, anyone who have an idea you wanted? And by the way, if you smoke them out, are you killing them?
No. They came out, a lot of them came out of the hives, and they just lay on the wall up out, you know, when we had the smoker outside. And then just once the smoke stopped, they just did back about their business again. No, it doesn't harm them. No. But
okay.
They did, a lot of them. And one of the guys that came, a beekeeper last summer, he said, like, there's thousands, because he knew by the amount of bees that was lying out on the wall waiting to get into the nest. And he said, you have 5,000 or 6,000 bees there.
Yeah.
So it's a big nest.
And how long has it been there?
2018.
Okay.
3 years.
Yeah. And have you asked around, like, have you...
Yes, but as I said, that's the one that I got. The beekeeper said to me, you know, if the roof would have to be lifted around the area, and then every bit of honey would have to be taken out of there because they go back in again. But I just thought if you could get them out and then just kind of spray foam the area, they wouldn't go back in again.
You'd block it up effectively.
Yes. Yeah.
Then beekeeper David Kelly called Joe.
The best thing you can do, Joe, really, is to contact a company called swarms.ie.
Swans.
Swarms. S-W-A-R-M-S.
Swarms. Sorry, swarms. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. And the reason I say that, Joe, is because they would have local beekeepers. Okay. This lady is in Galway, is that correct?
Yeah, Athenry.
Yeah, they would have local beekeepers who could deal with it there. Mm-hmm. And that way, the bees that are taken from her attic could be confined to more or less the Galway area. They can be tested to make sure there's no transmission of diseases.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
And can they? Okay. Is it easy to access where they are, Philomena?
Oh yes, it
is. Okay, brilliant. Okay, so a beekeeper. And what would the beekeeper do with the beehive, David?
We've quite a few very reputable females doing it now. But what they would do is they would take the comb from the attic with the bees, and once they have the queen.
Yeah,
all other bees will follow into that box.
Wow,
it's.
But David, is the beehive in Philomena's attic, so to speak, doing any harm?
The only possibility it may stain the ceiling coming out.
Okay, with the honey.
Yes.
Okay. So swarm.ie. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't get his first
That's
name.
That's David. David Kelly.
David, sorry. If you, I can get Scotland put up at, because it's a two-story house, you know, and if a beekeeper came and put a hive up there, would it lure the bees into it?
He could put up what's called a bait hive.
Yes.
And put some old frame into it, but you will only draw out the swarm, which will be the old queen and 60% of the bees that are in the hive at the moment.
Mm.
She will leave a queen cell, which will hatch. That queen will go off and get mated and come back to the remaining 40%, and the whole thing starts all over again.
All over again, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But if you want them out of your attic completely, mm-hmm. the best thing to do is to get onto swarms.ie, who will have
And David, when it's the time of year now where we would see bees swarming, won't we?
Yeah, well, I got one yesterday, Joe. I was in. I have a little group called Sea Bees.
Okay.
They're in Selbyshire. It's about all bees. It's about Irish black honeybees and bumblebees and solitary bees and whatever. And we meet in the Acre Project in Selbyshire every second Thursday. But it's just to keep familiarise people with stuff. But what happens is you will get people who will say, well, there's a swarm in my garden. Inevitably turns out to be wasps. nine times out of ten. Mm. But we don't mind. We don't mind going to these and just kind of letting people
know.
But
our swarms, when you see a swarm, be it wasps or bees, is it dangerous in itself?
No, it's not, Joe, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
It's far less dangerous to approach a swarm, even though we don't recommend it. It's far less dangerous to be around a swarm than it is a hive. Because a hive, the bees are basically protecting their home.
Okay.
A swarm is just where they've landed until they're trying to set up somewhere.
Yeah.
So it's not a serious danger.
And Steve Gallagher was on the line to talk about swarms.ie.
The largest national network in the world, as far as I understand.
Okay, and how did you come to set this up, Steve?
Necessity. There's 75 associations in the country. I was working for Norkilair a couple of years ago, and I discovered that people had a very difficult time finding somebody to help them with this. So needed an idea that was a single idea where they could very easily find one place that could help. So that's basically what started it off.
Andy, could you help Philomena, do you think? I know it's only over
there.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Oh, great.
And you can move the bees, but you don't kill them, do you?
No.
99% of the time, there's no need to kill the bees.
Okay, and what's the 1%?
It's okay, if they're listed buildings, if they're in like an eight-story take, it depends on the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is Swarms.ie a company, Steve? Is this your livelihood?
It's not a company, no. I do other bits and blobs with honeybees and stuff. This is just something that just really took off.
Okay,
it's kind
well
of like
done.
A charity, but sort
well
of.
Well done. Well done, you.
Well, in fairness, it's the guys who go, like Dave.
Yeah, of course.
Kelly,
you're the network.
I'm just the phone, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And David, bees are dying out. Are they overall? Or that's what we hear.
The numbers are depleting, all right, Joe, yeah.
And what can everyone do?
Stephen Ander, he phoned me yesterday. Okay. In connection to a swarm, and it's been nicely rehomed in a...
Okay, well done. What can people do, even with a small patch, to help bees?
Don't cut your lawn as often as you do.
Okay, don't cut your lawn as often, yeah. That's good advice. Yeah, I'll write that down. Yeah, that's great.
Dandelions are good.
They're good, yeah.
When bees come out of their hives, that's the snowdrop and dandelion are the first two things that they kind of really rely on. To build themselves back up.
Okay, so snowdrops, dandelions, and leave the lawnmower under the stairs or in the shed or whatever. Yeah.
Sorry, Joe. Yeah. Did David or Stephen, did I do any damage to them by having the smoker on, for a couple of days? No.
No.
That's good.
Okay, you're an innocent woman, Philomena.
Dave Kelly on the live line with Joe Duffy. And in the morning, Damien O'Reilly was looking at a new podcast about the Order of Mother Teresa.
There's hardly a person in this country who doesn't remember or at least know of the work of Mother Teresa. Revered for her work with the poor in India, she became an icon around the globe, and in 2016, she was proclaimed a saint by Pope Francis. But she was also a figure whose legacy is filled with controversy. A new podcast explores the lives of several women who joined and later departed from the Order of Mother Teresa. It's called The Turning, The Sisters Who Left, and I'm joined on the line now from the United States by its host, Erica Lance, and two former members of the Order, Kelly Dunham and Mary Johnson. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Erica, good morning.
To begin with you first, Erica, tell me a little bit more about the story behind the podcast and the series that you have managed to put together.
Well, I grew up hearing about Mother Teresa, and I think we all have heard a lot about Mother Teresa. She's such an icon in our culture. Even today, she's used as a shorthand for kindness. I hear, especially after working on this project, I just notice how I hear references to Mother Teresa in popular culture just all of the time. But I really didn't know much at all about the women who followed her, the Sisters of the Missionaries of Charity. And you see these photos of Mother Teresa in her iconic white and blue sari. And then there are all these other sisters around her wearing that same habit. And I didn't know who they were, why they were doing the work, what their lives were like. And that's what this podcast is about.
And for those of us old enough to remember Mother Teresa when she was alive and growing up listening to stories about her work, she mainly worked with the poorest of the poor in Calcutta. She was known as Mother Teresa of Calcutta. But just remind us of how she got to that point.
Yeah. So she was a nun with the Loreto Sisters, and they stationed her in Calcutta. And in 1946, she was on a train to a retreat when she heard a voice on the train, and a voice that she says she knew was Jesus. And the voice said to give up all and follow him to the slums to serve him in the poorest of the poor, and that he wanted Indian missionaries, Sisters of Charity, who would be his fire of love amongst the very poor and bring their souls to me being Jesus. And this was an incredible turning point in her life. And this was her calling, her call within the call to found her own religious congregation of sisters, which she eventually got permission to do. And in 1950, she founded the Order of the Missionaries of Charity in Calcutta. But after that, it spread around the world. MC houses were around the world. There are MC houses all over the United States, where I'm based, for example, and thousands of women joined the Order as sisters.
She was Albanian by birth, but began her career as a sister actually here in Ireland, as you say, with the Loreto nuns.
That's right. But she eventually became an Indian citizen and considered herself Indian for the rest of her life.
You felt it was important to share stories of those living in her order. This is not necessarily a podcast series about Mother Teresa critiquing her, but about the women who joined the order.
That's right, exactly. And especially women who joined and then left the order. You know, what when you feel this call and you take vows for life to be a sister, what is it that would lead you to eventually leave, which is really not an easy decision for a missionary of charity to make. It's unbelievably wrenching to make a decision like that. So what would lead you to make that decision? And then how do you leave religious life?
Erica Lance there. And Damien asked Mary Johnson about joining the order.
Well, in 1976, I was a senior in high school, and I was walking by the library and saw a picture of Mother Teresa's face on the cover of Time magazine. And it just kind of drew me in. I immediately went to the library. I read this article about how she was caring for the poor in India, how she was picking dying people up off the street. And my heart was completely moved. And I really felt in that moment that God was asking me and showing me that this was to be my life forward. And I started looking for ways to contact the sisters, and eventually I did. I joined in the South Bronx in 1977, and I was just really drawn to this life of love. I really felt like the world needed love, and I know that's a song, but for me, it was just really, I think from my own experience, I felt like to be seen, to be held, to be known, to be loved was really what people needed. And that's what drew me in.
So you were marrying yourself to Jesus?
Yes, I didn't look at it quite that way. Mother Teresa certainly did. But when I first entered, I thought of it more as Jesus and I will be partners in this work of bringing God's love to the world. But of course, the Missionaries of Charity spirituality was that sense of being wed to Christ. And so that is what I tried to adopt, that kind of outlook.
When you joined, did you believe that you were joining an order where you would have to completely surrender all that you more or less had, and that you would be signing up for not only a vow of poverty, a vow of chastity, but somewhat a vow of suffering?
When I joined, I knew that the Missionaries of Charity were a very radical order, that they took poverty very seriously. I had a sense that they took obedience very seriously, that their life of service was something which really entered into every aspect of their lives. I knew that they took those things more seriously than other orders did. And quite frankly, that was part of the draw, because being an idealistic 19-year-old, I really wanted to give my life to something that mattered and to live in a way where I could feel like I was making a difference. I had no idea that it would involve certain elements of suffering, yes, of looking upon Jesus on the cross as the ideal. That, yes, we are to suffer with Jesus and we are to minister to Jesus' suffering, but that suffering had such a great value to the extent that we were to cut ourselves off from our families, able to visit home only once every 10 years, that we would have our home letters once a month reviewed before they would be sent to our parents. I had no idea that eventually practices of extreme corporal penance would be involved. All of those things were revealed slowly after you've already made quite an initial investment in the group and you're already starting to live in this very closed society where you don't have much outside input. So, yes, the revelation of exactly what this life would entail was something that came about slowly.
And even though you would have been expecting a part of that. Kelly, Mary refers there to the fact that you were leaving your family behind and leaving your past behind and leaving the outside world behind. You would be allowed to visit your family maybe once, as she says, every 10 years. But just talk to me about the idea behind the Missionary of Charity training being just like military training to break you down into nothing. Was it that severe?
That wasn't even the mistaken idea. That was actually, you know, they said what we want you to do is to become only for Jesus, to attach only to Jesus. That was true in terms of your connections with other people. I remember one sister getting kind of, you know, we use the term scolded for actually not hanging up her underwear correctly on the line. And I looked at that sister and I could see she was about to cry. And I looked at her and mouthed, we were in silence, just, are you okay? And then my mistress, my aspirant mistress, you know, scolded both of us for having that kind of human connection. And she was like, only Jesus can make it okay, you know? And even some of the physical things, like I think of one, you know, like, well, understand that that's like Mary said, that, you know, the idea of offering up suffering for Jesus, this is not something nobody has ever heard of. This is a teaching. We understand this, but it's just taken to kind of a very banana pants level. You know, like I remember an aspirant mistress said to us one day, like, sister, if you really love Jesus, you mortify yourself by only going to the bathroom once a day. And I thought she was joking. I was like, oh, okay, saw me Sister Mary bladder infection, you know, but she was not joking. So it was the level of kind of what they took it to.
And Damien asked if all this deflected from working with the poor.
And did this take away from the primary focus that we believed was the reason for the order, and that was to actually help the poorest of the poor? Did that continue anyway?
That's such a brilliant question. Thank you for putting my whole life in focus. Yes, absolutely. That was the problem. It was the, you know, like if your vow is wholehearted and free service to the poorest of the poor, if your heart is systematically being like tromped upon, how are you going to bring your whole heart then? It's actually impossible to bring your whole heart to people. So, that was one of the frustrations. Now, understand, like, training, right? Like, you know, when you go to boot camp, you have training to make you become better, but there is, you know, I was going to say there are limits to these things, but in the MCs, there are not limits.
You know? And for both of you, it wore you down to the point that you both actually left. Mary, for you, how did that happen? How long did you stay there? And what eventually made you decide that you needed to leave?
I stayed for 20 years. And during that time, I was given a great deal of responsibility. I knew Mother Teresa fairly well, and not that anyone knew her really personally among the sisters, but I had a lot of contact with her. She knew who I was. She had put me in charge of preparing the sisters for their final vows. So I was someone with a great deal of responsibility in the group. But even with that, there were so many things that I couldn't do. I couldn't get permission to actually enact programs that would help people out of poverty. I had volunteers who had come forward with an idea of a knitting initiative to help refugee women in Rome. And when I presented this, they said, no, you cannot do that. There's just no explanation as to why not, just no. And obedience must always be simple, constant, and blind. So that was it. I came to believe that God was calling me to the fullness of life. The passage from the gospel where Jesus says, I came that you may have life and have it to the full. This was kept reverberating in my mind. And I was just feeling like my life was becoming smaller and smaller. I came to realize I needed more intimate relationships than the rules allowed, just a friendship with someone. And the last year I was there, I started the year saying, I'm going to keep all the rules this year. I'm going to be the best I can. And if by the end of the year I see that I can't really be myself in this group, I'm going to leave, because I believe Jesus when he says, I came that you may have life and have it to the full. And it was just really clear to me that leaving was what I needed to do. I felt that just as God had called me in, God was calling me out.
Yeah, and in the podcast you explain how exactly you went about leaving and how you had to actually plan that out. Kelly, just back to you, was it difficult to reintegrate into general society after leaving?
It was. It was very difficult for a couple of reasons. My own shame at some points in making that decision, right? I was walking around Philadelphia in 1998. I didn't know anybody who, you know, had just left a convent. Like, there was nobody like that. So I had kind of shame about, like, both making that choice. And then also it's a very dramatic, like, I'm off to be married to Jesus. Oh, I'm not really, you know, it's kind of a dramatic leaving in that way. I remember I carried around a notebook with me that had like a cartoon of somebody saying, am I, like, in a job interview saying, am I a team player? Are you kidding? I was in a cult, and I had crossed out cult and put convent, and helped me make me feel like I was not not so alone. But I had a big gap in my resume. I remember I didn't have any, I mean, luckily my sister let me stay with her, but I didn't have any job skills really. So I was selling plasma for the first 6 months just to kind of get money for food. It was not an easy transition, and I was also in such a short time comparatively. So I know, like, other sisters who have left after long periods of time or sisters who aren't able to leave because maybe their families couldn't afford to take them back, or they wouldn't want to put that, as they see, a burden on their families. Like, I was very lucky in that way. So, but yes, it was not smooth by any stretch of the imagination.
Kelly Dunham and Mary Johnson of the podcast The Turning, from Today with Damien O'Reilly. And on the Ray Darcy Show, her very impressive conversion of a shipping container won the big DIY challenge on RTE TV. Katrina Bergen was Ray's guest in the afternoon.
I got very excited, yeah, of course.
Well, they were a bit devious as well, weren't they?
They were particularly devious, yes.
What happened?
So, yeah, they had PJ hiding in the... He had to lie down on the floor of the van.
Right.
So I wouldn't see him. And I thought it was just an update interview.
A catch-up, yes.
Yeah, just then, a catch-up, basically, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, and they even said that they'd be coming back on June 4th. So they gave me a date, like, way ahead. And I was like, oh, no, really? Oh,
yeah. A viewer, it worked really well. He popped out from behind your shipping container, and that's why you won. You did an amazing job in 10 days. You converted a shipping container into three sort of functional spaces.
I did, yeah. Yeah. I still can't believe I actually did it.
You did do
or
it, didn't
won.
You? You did do
it. I'm doing it.
So 10 days. And now, will you tell people what experience you had before this? Because people watch these programs and they think, oh, sure, she's been doing that for years. You've been welding for years. Had you?
Oh, God. I learned how to weld a week before in order to be able to do the bits I needed to do. Because I just said, right, if I'm going to do this, I'm doing it all, and I'm doing it all on my own. So, and I've always wanted to learn how to weld. So good excuse.
Is that stubbornness or independence? Which are a bit of both?
A healthy dose of both.
Both, right. Okay. Yeah. And what about the tiling? Had you done tiling before?
Yes, I did. I did an entire, I think it was 8 or 10 tiles I stuck around my sink really badly. And I stuck, people will be disgusted when they hear this. I actually stuck them down with grout because I was too lazy to mix up the tile adhesive.
Does that work? It's a lot more expensive, I would imagine, but does it work?
No, it's really bad. They all came off.
Oh, so did they? Right, I
had to do them properly afterwards. Okay.
So you had this shipping container, and was it where did it come from? Did you buy it specially for this project, or was it lying around somewhere?
Well, it's a long story, but I'll get as quick as I can. But I basically was looking for them because I was originally going to do snail farming.
Okay.
Because that's exactly what you're going to do when you come up here.
Right.
So a friend of mine said she knew someone who had them who just wanted them taken away. So I said, right, I'll take them away. So I had to pay for them to get delivered here. And then I had them sitting one stacked up on the other, just kind of filling up with stuff and rubbish.
And it's two stuck together, is it?
No, I know
one.
I have two.
You only did
that
one,
was
right.
The top one. So I took...
Go on, snail farming. I have to find out about snail farming. So why did you not do snail farming in the end?
Well, I did a lot of research and I went to a lot of conferences and I did classes and I did all sorts of courses and things like that. And I realised there's no money in it.
Okay, so, right. Yeah. Okay, that's why you didn't do that. Okay. Now, you're originally from Sandyford.
Yes, I am.
Dublin 18. So why the move from Sandyford to Leitrim? And what were you doing in Dublin before you left?
I was working for the RFU. I was the Women's Rugby Development Officer for the country.
All right. So a high power job.
Oh, yeah, as you do.
Yeah. And why did you make the move?
Well, my eldest brother, Avna, died by suicide in 2012. And it kind of caused a bit of a shift in just taking stock of life and wondering whether what I was doing was the right thing, you know. Mm. Getting the good job, buying the house, you know, finding somebody, getting married, having kids, that kind of a pathway. Mm. And I just had to question everything, you know.
Right. As you do when something like that happens.
Yeah. And I just thought, you know, I'm doing this job. I love the job, but I was just getting very stressed. You sit in a car in terrible traffic all the time, stress your eyeballs on the way into work. You go and you have to deal with a boss who's, you know, annoying you or doing whatever. And then you have to get back in that car, get the stress of getting home. And you have to do that 5 days a week. And come the weekend, you're exhausted, emotional. What I used to do, my Friday night was to make my spaghetti bolognese, open a bottle of wine, find the saddest movie I could find and just cry.
Right.
Like that was it, was to just get all that stress and anxiety out. And then I'd feel a little bit more alive for the weekend. So, and that's kind of a sorry state of affairs.
It is. It's not really living, is it?
No. It's surviving. It's not. Nothing else but surviving. And that's what I was doing in Dublin. And, you know, I have and still have fantastic friends, but you kind of all get dragged off into your own little lives.
Yes.
And you kind of get left and I, you know, you can get pretty lonely in a big city, and it doesn't matter how many people are around you all of the time, you can actually feel particularly lonely, you know. So I decided I needed to change and do something different.
That's Katrina Bergen, winner of the Big DIY Challenge on RTE TV on the Ray Darcy Show. Well, it's a warm weekend ahead, and on the live line, lifeguard Aaron called Joe after a swim in Clontarf and his concerns about the use of jet skis.
Well, I tell you, Joe, I've been a lifelong swimmer. I'm 50 years old, and I just re-qualified as a lifeguard this year, so I'm fairly aware of what happens at sea.
Okay.
And if you play golf or anything like that, you'd know that if you hit a ball in a fairway, you can't see it, and you almost get on top of it sometimes, because it might be behind a small tuft of grass.
Mm-hmm.
But in the sea, the waves are, they hide things very easy, and swimmers are very difficult to see on the sea surface.
Okay.
But we're having a problem with like in Cork now, the signs on all the jetties saying that jet skis should use the jetty. We all want everybody to use the sea, but they should taxi out slowly into 200 metres offshore before they start doing their acrobatics, right? But we're finding there, last week we had a group of people down here, and honest to God, they were doing it within metres of sea swimmers. Young children were in the water, and they were doing this kind of, I don't know what you call it, showboating type thing, you know, where they'd be bouncing the boat around the place over waves and kind of making, but so close to swimmers that you'd actually be really frightened for their lives, you know. Now, we've seen them before lots of times down here, and many a time we've said to them, have they seen swimmers in the water? Because we know that they've come close to swimmers, and they have said they hadn't even seen the swimmers.
Of course you wouldn't. How would you see the water can be grey, stroke blue, stroke turquoise, stroke black. How would you spot a grey head or a dark haired person swimming?
Oh, absolutely. I've got fellas here, basically. We're quite an older group here. We've got a few grey haired fellas here in the water with us. And I tell you, I'd find it difficult to see them standing on a pier looking down into the water. You'd still have difficulty seeing with them. So it's a bit of an issue, you know. But it's actually been tackled a little bit by the council. There's a question being put up by Captain Stoker this weekend about the issue. But they say that they shouldn't be tackling what's happening on the sea, right?
Yeah.
No, nobody seems to have any actual powers at sea. The Gardaí, their powers stop at the edge of the water.
Okay.
These guys are going in doing this stuff. Look, anybody That's can right. buy like.
And how...
If I wanted to get a powerboat, I'd have to do a powerboat license. But to get a jet ski, I just have to have a few quid in my pocket.
Oh, you'd need no validated or verified training.
No,
there's no verified or validated exam.
No, and if you go down to any of the Mediterranean countries or Germany, you go off the coast of basically Denmark, anywhere else, they have to taxi out. There's a lane made for them, so they're completely segregated from swimmers. Because we've seen it, you know, Shane McGowan's partner got hit by one years ago, God rest her. And we know that these things happen on a frequent basis, you know. But I'm afraid they're going to wait till an accident happens before they do something. Now, like I said, every jetty in Cork has a sign for jet skis. So we're only asking that.
Are you thinking of Kirsty McCall?
Kirsty, yeah.
Yes, his singing partner. Yes, she was killed, and I think it was the Gulf of Mexico, whatever. I thought that was a boat, whatever. But still, it was horrific. You have an incredible phrase here. You say it's akin letting jet skis fly around beaches and where the especially on the good weather that's expected, is akin to getting on a motorbike and flying around the playground.
Well, I don't see the difference. These guys, listen, Joe, I know it sounds terrible because I don't want to stereotype people, right?
Yeah, I know.
But they came down the other day, right? We asked them very gently because they were at a buoy that was, like, we know where they were swimming to. The buoy is 20, 30 metres offshore. Mm-hmm. And they were doing, like, going around this thing. Like I said, there was young children in the water and they came within metres of them. Because you can see they leave a bubble trail behind the boat. We can know exactly where they've been so they can see clearly.
Okay.
I said, lads, do you mind moving away? And listen, there's an awful basin. I know I shouldn't say it, but there was an awful bang of marijuana off them, you know what I mean? And they were actually getting cars with kids, and the young kids getting the cars. It's school time. Kids should have been in school. The smoke's building out of the oaks. They're driving around like basically lunatics, Joe.
Well, that was Aaron. Then Jason wanted to tell us the difference between jet skis and jet scooters.
Jet skis and jet scooters. Just, I wanted to clarify, there's two different types. There's the jet scooter, which is basically like a motorcycle. You could just jump on, hook it on, start it up, and off you go. A jet ski has got a different situation where you have to stand at the back. You need a fair amount of skill to use them, and you need to lift up the front of the machine to get it going. The difficulty with jet scooters is that, as I said, anybody can drive them. They also, the majority of them wouldn't have a neutral, so there's really no way to stop them other than pulling the kill cord. A lot of people don't know that, and as I said to you, they tend to attract people who have no background in water sports whatsoever. And therefore, as the gentleman rightly previously said, they tend to just abuse them. I've seen accidents where people have hit stumps on the water, etc., and been killed outright with jet scooters. They're 700cc, they're 1200cc, they're massively powerful boat machines. They were designed for rescue and surf and in reef areas. I've used them myself as security boats, and they're very useful for that reason. But generally, for flying up and down the coast, they really are a nuisance. They need to be patrolled properly, and I think there is legislation in Ireland regarding jet scooters already, and you'll find a lot of areas where they'd just be banned, I know, in around marinas, etc.
And then the jet ski.
The jet ski is
now, do they look different, Jason?
They look different as well, okay. The jet ski is sort of narrower, and she'd have the front on it would actually, you'd have to raise up the front to get her going. And same sort of throttle situation, but you're actually standing at the back of it, balancing. And they're used for tricks, they're speedy machines as well, but you'd need a fair amount of skill to use them. Whereas the jet scooter is, you can put anyone on it. But it's a trigger which accelerates the vessel over the water. And as I said, you should be wearing a kill cord, which basically, if you fall off the jet scooter, it pulls as you fall off,
and it dies.
It kills the engine.
And how much is a jet ski? Do you know, Jason, how much is a jet scooter?
Six to ten grand. 6,000 to 10 grand. I mean, you can get them cheaper, obviously.
But is that for a jet scooter or a jet ski?
That's a jet scooter, yeah. Jet ski would be, I'm not too sure about the jet ski, the prices these days.
And the jet skis,
they are different machines.
But the jet ski is much more powerful.
Jet ski is not as powerful as a jet scooter.
Then I'm totally confused now. Why? Because I'm thinking of the word scooter.
Yeah,
meaning
scooter,
slow and...
No, it's just that they're called scooters because the way you sit on them, they're more like a motorcycle versus a jet ski. You're actually sitting standing on it like a ski in many senses. Yeah, it's something between your feet.
And
a lot of people starting off, they'll be lying in the water to get them going, etc.
Okay,
so your jet scooter is sort of anybody can jump on. You know,
for the scooter, do you need any training?
Personal water safety craft, I think they're called now. And yes, it's always advisable, but I don't think it's enforced.
It's not obligatory.
I think anybody can just buy them on the deal and away they go.
Is it mandatory?
It's not mandatory over here, as far as I'm aware. But again, I could be correct on that. ISA would be the people to approach on that.
Have you noticed an increase in the number of these vehicles on the waves?
Of course.
And the lockdown.
And again, with the staycation, people are buying things to get on the water quickly for their 2 weeks vacation, etc. I mean, ostensibly the machines have a purpose. It's just they're being misused. So as that gentleman said previously, it's like putting a motorcycle inside a playground. It is in many senses, except a motorcycle, you can put in neutral and have it stopped. And if you fall off it, it'll drop dead. a jet scooter okay. potentially has the risk, if you're not wearing a kill cord on it, can mm. just keep on travelling.
Mother of divine.
Yeah, and if you have a 700cc or a 1200cc Yamaha engine
which
under
is them, a motorbike.
It's a motorbike, absolutely, yeah, yeah. and a high-powered one, you know.
Yeah,
and they don't have a propeller. They have their jet scooters, so they push out water through a series of tubes at the back of the boat. So in that sense, they're safer. But if something that heavy hits you, you know, it doesn't matter if there's a prop or not on it, yeah. you're still going to get some serious damage.
Are you sure?
Well, that's Jason, then Pat called Joe. He's a sea swimmer year-round, and he's had enough of jet skis.
Oh, Joe, I have in the past, I could write a book about jet skis and swimmers and use of the jet skis and near beaches and launching points. I have noticed a big increase, and particularly last year and this year, if any sort of good weather, they'll be out. Now, there's a number who are responsible, but there's an awful lot who are just irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you what I've noticed. It seems to be on a good day when the weather conditions are beautiful, they seem to want to go where the crowd is at the beaches and where people are swimming. And they're launching, say, at a slipway, and then they'll go to a beach and they'll swap around and they'll let their family onto it. I've seen parents letting their children onto it, going onto the beach. And there's other swimmers there. And
crazy, dangerously crazy.
Joe, I have had to walk away because...
your nerves are looking to see what
nerves, and I'll give you one example there. A couple of weeks ago, we were swimming. There was a group of us. We have all the floats, the orange floats swimming, and we came across a jet ski coming into a beach. I spoke to him because I was ahead, and I said, look, there's about 20 swimmers coming mm-hmm. behind me now. So what did they do? This is all grand, we're aware of it, but no. Out and back in, and... within about 10 feet of one of the swimmers. It was quite wavy. They didn't see the swimmer and just missed them. But it's not only about swimmers. It's about kids on the beach.
Yeah.
They're coming into the beaches to change drivers and then putting children on them as well. And they're tearing up and down and they're not. They were within 20, 30 feet.
Annie, did you ever see, again, it's a grey area. Who polices this?
Well, Joe, I've had this. It's the Maritime Safety Act 2005. The council can make regulations barring and policing of jet skis, but there's provisions in that act that prevent personal watercraft with their jet skis from behaving unreasonably where there's other water users or even people on the beach where they are interfering with their enjoyment of it.
Okay.
And there's powers there for the guards to go down, demand name and addresses, and they can even seize the jet skis under the Maritime Safety Act. If it's serious enough, under various sections of it, Section 10 is one of them, and on from there, and there's fines, prosecutions can be taken. But it is difficult to police because they're in the jet ski, they're out in the sea, the guards mm-hmm. arrive, so they just go off to where they have launched. And jet skis, there is a large group, a jet ski society in Ireland. And
is that okay?
The people who are in that are very responsible, mm-hmm. but they're not the ones who are going up and down the beach and where swimmers are. And Joe, I've seen it too much.
That's Pat on the live line with Joe Duffy. Now, the See Yourself on Screen Challenge, TG Cahir and BBC presenter Caoimhne Cahill joined Oliver Callan on the line to tell him all about it.
Well, I am one of the mentors this year. It was run for the first time last year and I was a mentor and I'm delighted to be asked back this year. They've got lots of people in the industry because it is all over Ireland and the UK. Mm-hmm. So the likes of Connie Hawke and Harry Hill and Reggie Yates and then me here in Ireland because I have presented in the past and continue to do so.
You have a gorgeous Donegal blass.
I would hope so. Sure, it's the best Irish and English in Donegal.
What part of Donegal are you from?
I'm from Letterkenny.
Oh yes, very nice. Yeah. It's very specific.
The gateway to everywhere else.
What's that?
The gateway to everywhere else in the county.
Well, that's an interesting one. Everyone kind of sees the end of the world when you get up the Hookhead Peninsula. Okay, very good. What do you do, by the way? You present on BBC, don't you?
Yes, so I present both radio and TV. So I have a radio show on BBC Radio Ulster and then present TV for BBC and TG Cahir. So I would do a lot of stuff kind of geared towards the 18 to 35-year-olds and have started out, I suppose, when I was back in DCU in college still and presented children's TV for TG Cahir. So that was a brilliant experience, you know, a summer job when you're still in university with my friend Aideen. So that was 52 episodes of children's TV, which is forever going to be on TG Cahir, I would assume, as it's still on. But yeah, no, I'm kind of still presenting and based in Belfast because there are definitely a lot of opportunities there.
I mean, yeah, because you have the speed of language that's required for children's television. Because in South Donegal,
so high accent.
Yeah, you got the North Donegal thing because it's much quicker, whereas South Donegal is the Daniel thing, isn't it? Really.
Well, it's a massive county. I don't think people believe that we all have different accents, you know, because Donegal is so massive and different dialects and everything. But yeah, no, definitely the Donegal Irish and then paired with my friend Aideen's kind of Wicklow Irish, if that is a thing, on the TV was brilliant for kids, I think.
I struggled enough because I had a Donegal Irish teacher and it was instead of Canuck, it was Crook.
Yeah, and, crook.
Yeah, I have no idea what Wicklow Irish sounds like. I'm leading you way down off the path here. So anyway, tell us about See Yourself on Screen. What do you want from young people?
Yeah, so this is a challenge run by, as you said, the BFI, so the British Film Institute, and it's in line with their Young Audiences Content Fund. So what they're asking is for people aged 4 to 18 across Ireland and the UK to submit a 30-second video summarising their idea for what would be a 2-minute-long mini TV show. Okay. And the winner in Ireland, their 2-minute TV show will be broadcast on TG Cahir, so it's an amazing opportunity for young people out there to get, you know, their idea and their short show on TG Cahir. There's a theme with it this year as well, because 75 years ago was the start of children's programming. So after World War II, the BBC started kind of a children's hour on a Sunday. So it's the 75th anniversary of that. So we're asking the young people to look 75 years into the future. So what would their idea for a TV show set in 2096 be? Wow. So I can only imagine what kind of ideas are going to be coming in, because, you know, young people are just so creative. So it's nice to have a theme for them and kind of see what they think a TV show set in 2096 would look like. So we ask them to send in an initial 30-second video, and then they will receive some mentoring from myself and, you know, a lot of support from TG Cahir, and then their 2-minute video will be broadcast on TG Cahir.
Brilliant. So they're too long mini TV show. That's the idea they come up with. They're doing 30-second videos to propose that.
Just to kind of summarise what their idea is and to give us an idea, and then a panel of judges will judge all those entries, and one winner from Ireland will be chosen, and then lots of winners in Britain as well, and then the Irish winners video will be broadcast on TG Cahir.
It's kind of incredible to think that there was children's TV shows as far back as 1946.
I know, I really don't remember it myself, but it seems to be such a you know, kind of a historic moment, because there wasn't anything before that, so yeah. You know, 75 years ago that they started out with that children's hour, and sure, now, you know, you can watch children's TV 24 hours a day, and some children maybe do, but
they do.
It's everywhere now, you know, so it's nice to kind of to look back at that, but then also look into the future, because children's TV and, you know, content for young audiences is always having to adapt and having to, you know, keep up with what children are looking to watch. So it'll be interesting to see what the children themselves, you know, would like to watch and would like to be a part of.
Cuimhinní Cathal with Oliver Callan in the morning. And on the live line, the fascinating life of Sister Fiacra Nutty.
I'm in St Mary's Abbey, Glencairn, just outside Lismore in West Waterford.
Which is an enclosed Cistercian order.
It is indeed.
And how has the pandemic almost made your work redundant?
Well, it's made some of our work redundant.
Okay.
Our primary work here, Joe, is prayer.
Yeah, right? Of course.
So that's the first thing to be said, because we actually go to church 7 times a day, starting off at 4:10 in the morning.
Right.
Okay. But our actual manual work that we engage in, we have a 3-way split here in our monastery.
Okay.
We have Eucharist bread, we have a card department, and we have a farm.
Okay, and which one were you working in, Sister?
Well, up to September of last year, I was working in Eucharist bread.
Okay, making the Eucharist for the sacrament, for the Mass.
Exactly,
okay.
But you can imagine what happened during the pandemic.
Of course.
You know, it was like the guillotine dropped. and what had been a very successful business, which was thriving, doing really well, just stopped.
And how do you make the Eucharist?
Right. We start off with a flour that is actually produced in this country specifically for the process. It is so fine, Joe, you wouldn't want to sneeze, right?
Okay.
Because you destroy yourself.
And what's that flour called, Sister Peter?
And it's altar bread flour. It's really, really fine.
Okay.
It's like talcum powder. Okay.
Yeah.
And to that, we only add one other ingredient, and that is our own spring water.
And you just mix it and mix it and mix it.
And we mix it together and we make it into a batter, which is for all the world like pancake batter, only thinner.
Yeah. Are there different sizes of Eucharist?
There certainly are. We do five sizes here. We have what we call the people's host, which is 3 centimeter size, which people around the country will be very, very familiar with receiving in the hand at communion. And then we have the standard priest's host, which is 7 centimeters in diameter.
Okay.
Then we do what we call the canon, which is 9 centimeters.
Okay.
We have a bishop at 12 centimetres and we have a cardinal at 15 centimetres.
But
we've not yet got around to making a pope.
Oh, that's fantastic. Five of them. People, priest, canon, bishop, cardinal.
That's it. And we also make them in white and brown.
And gluten-free, I presume?
No, we don't do gluten-free.
Oh, do you not know?
And there's a very simple reason for that, and that is that by canon law, it has to. The bread that's consecrated at the altar must have a percentage of wheat.
Okay.
So we can't produce a gluten-free host.
That's interesting.
And be in conformity with canon law.
And Jo asked Sister Fiacra about her life before the Cistercians.
And whereabouts are you from originally?
Malahide.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when did you find your vocation?
That's a very long story, Jo.
Okay, you know me.
But suffice to say that I started in the horticultural industry.
Yeah.
Myself and my brother ran a very successful garden centre in Malahide for 23 years.
Wow.
We sold that in the late 90s.
Okay.
And at that point, I went to England to do a degree in horticulture because I had always wanted to do a degree, but I had left school at 16 with my leaving cert and gone straight into the business.
Okay.
So I'd never had an opportunity to do a degree. So I went to England and I had the most fabulous 7 years over there, visiting all gardens of all shapes, makes and kinds, National Trust, the whole lot, and completing my degree over there. And it was really while there that the Lord got a hold on me.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It was quite the journey.
And you have a working farm.
We go to church 7 times a day.
You're saying it's beginning at 10 past 4 in the morning.
Beginning at 10 past 4. God,
you're nearly up as early as the Ian Road Aaron fellas making all the noise up in Colester.
That's right. That's right.
So ten past four.
It's a lot quieter here.
I'd say it is, thankfully. So 10 past 4. How long does that service last for?
That lasts an hour, and then we have 20 minutes quiet prayer after it. So you know,
so 10 past 4. Time. 10 past 5. We're now up to 5:30.
Yeah, and then we have breakfast.
which consists of?
Oh, just as you would have breakfast at home.
Porridge
or whatever. Yeah.
Okay. 5:30. So what time do we finish breakfast at?
Well, that's depending on how greedy you are, I suppose.
Okay, there's no greedy non-stop.
Not at all. No.
So 5:30, and then are you back into church then at 6:30?
No, we go to do our scripture reading at that point.
Okay.
So we do that up until 7:45.
Yeah.
And 7:45 is our second office, which lasts 30 minutes.
Aye.
Immediately after which we have Mass. And that brings us up to 9:00.
Yeah.
And we have a cup of tea.
Thank God.
Yeah, you need it then.
Yeah.
Then we go back into church for a very short office, which only lasts about 10, 12 minutes.
Okay.
And then we have chapter every day, which is the occasion when if there's matters to be discussed or the abbot wants to make announcements, and that lasts maybe 10, 15 minutes.
Okay.
And then we go to work.
Yeah, doing your bread or your greeting cards at the farm or whatever.
Yeah, that starts at 10:30. So, like, we've been up since 10 to 4, but we're only getting to work at 10:30.
Okay, so 10:30 work. What time, light lunch, I suspect. What time do you have lunch?
Well, first of all, we go back to church and we have another 12-minute office and then we have lunch at 1:00.
Okay.
So that's 1 to 1:30.
Yeah.
And then we have the joy of a siesta. We're allowed to go to bed for an hour if we'd like.
Yes.
But many of us choose instead to go walking in the grounds down by the river or whatever.
So we're at 10 to 3 now in the afternoon. You've been up 11 hours at that stage. What's next, sister?
Well, we have another 12, 15 minute office just coming up to 3 o'clock, Joe.
Yeah.
And after that, we go back to work. And we continue working until about 5:15.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we have our supper before we go to church for Vespers at 6 o'clock.
Right.
And that lasts a half an hour.
Yeah.
And we have 15 minutes quiet prayer meditation.
Yeah.
We have a 40-minute break.
Yeah.
We have the office of Compline. And Joe, at that point, we're ready for bed.
And what time is that?
That's 8:30.
And you're in bed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sister Fiachraine Nutty on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on the live line.
The job in hand was to handwrite a poem about 5151 washer hands. I don't know if I heard it first hand, second hand, or third hand, but hand on hand from my soft hands who never did a hard day's work in their life, I tried to write this goodbye to 5151 washer hands, but it was out of my hands. So I hold my hands up. I did get a helping hand. I went cap in hand. I said, "Can you give us a hand?" And I left it in their hands. And then by their own hand, they wrote, "My hands are full." So they couldn't lend a hand with 5151 washer hands. I thought I could count my friends on more than one hand, but my hands were tied unless I could get all hands on deck. I got poets with time in their hands. They held my hand. And with a guiding hand, using a handbook, I have to hand it to them. We handmade this poem and hand-signed it, but it was too heavy-handed. We realised the task was out of our hands because we don't have gifted hands. Hands up or hands down. That was the hand signal that the poem, 5151 washer hands, had got out of hand. So now I will wait hand and foot as you hand me down your handouts, your hand-printed handsome words, your golden handshake. As you tell me, we all have the whole world in our 5151 washer hands. Lavez-vous les mains? Nig de lave? Vache dina handa? Lavate le mani? My life is in your hands. But it was the healing hands, the gifted hands, the holding hands, the open hands that had the whip hand. When the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing, we got the upper hand. As hand in hand, we came through a pandemic, a handemic that was a handful, not from the hand of God, as we said. Get your dirty, filthy hands off of me. As it got out of hand, we did not hold our hands, but we did 5151 washer hands. And now we've more time in our hands, hands free. We will wash our hands of this pandemic, this handemic, because we can-demic. And so with a freer hand, raise a glass of clear water to every son and daughter, mother and father, uncle and aunt, siblings and friends to the end, to all those we missed and lost and loved from a distance, to the anonymous 5151s washing their hands. For the clean hands, thank you. For the healing hands, thank you. For the hands that wiped away tears, take a bow. The soon that we hope for is now. So by a show of hands, we say goodbye to 51551 washer hands.
On the live line with Joe Duffy. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.